We live in a society where one of the things that we regularly teach our children, is not to gossip. And it's an incessant focus on certain aspects of how we teach people. And in today's shiur, I want to focus on the reverse of that, which is, in what situations and when are we supposed to recount bad information we hear about other people? Because it's worth emphasizing over and over again that Hilchot Lashon Hara is a balance of two distinctly different values that are, to some extent, at least overlappingly incompatible. One is the obligation not to recount rumors in situations where recounting the rumor is irrelevant. And the other is an obligation to repeat information to people who need to have this information to prevent a wrong. And that when you see somebody plotting and planning against a person, there's a halachic obligation to reveal that information and say, so-and-so is doing a wrong against you, you need to be aware of this fact. And indeed, relating directly to the day, the central story of this involves Gedaliah ben Achikam. Gedaliah ben Achikam, for whom today's fast is named after, was the leader of the Jewish people after the destruction of the first Beis HaMikdash. He was in a difficult political situation. He was trying to restore Jewish sovereignty, and there were many people who didn't like him. And indeed, not only were there many people who didn't like him, there were many people who wished to kill him. And he had an advisor named Yochanan ben Kerach, who went to Gedaliah and said, you know, there are a lot of bad people out there. You need to be very careful, because if you're not careful, you know what they're going to do? They're going to assassinate you, and that would be very bad for you and very bad for the Jewish people. And Gedaliah ben Achikam said as follows, I don't believe you. That is classical Lashon Hara. And I can't believe that there are people out there who would set out to kill me, because that's the sort of gossip that the Torah commands you not to obey. So the Gemara says, if we turn to page number 3, source number 1, count down 7 lines. The last 4 words of the line. Ela mitoch shehayu lo lachush le'etzat Yochanan ben Korach v'lo chash. He was supposed to listen or consider the advice of Yochanan ben Korach, and he didn't. He's considered, so to speak, as if he had engaged in the killing himself. The Gemara says, Gedaliah ben Achikam made a mistake. The mistake Gedaliah ben Achikam made is that when he heard a rumor that people were planning on doing terrible things to him, he shouldn't have said, I believe the rumor, but he simultaneously shouldn't have said, I don't believe the rumor. What he should have said is, gosh, this is a very interesting piece of information. I better consider it. Maybe it's true. Maybe it's not true. And he should have done things under the possibility that this information is true. Like what? Beef up his security. Install metal detectors. Whatever exactly presidential security looks like in the year 500 B.C., Gedaliah ben Achikam was supposed to do, because he was told there was a threat against his life. And indeed, the Gemara continues with another story to hammer this point through. Skip down one more line. Dahanu b'nei Galili. There were these Galilean men. Dinafik alayu kala de kittel nafshe. That the rumor had gone out that they had killed people. Also l'kaimei de Rabbi Tarfon. They came in front of Rabbi Tarfon. Amru lei litmerun mar. They said to Rabbi Tarfon, please hide us. Help us flee. Amar lehu hachi navin. And he said, what should I do? Ilo atmenuchinu chazus chaychot rechu ha'amu rabbanin hai lishna bisha. Afagav de kibbo mibaya mechush lehu mibaya. Rabbi Tarfon said, I'm in a dilemma. If I accept the information is true, that you kill people, then I shouldn't hide you. On the other hand, if I accept your claim to me, which is that you didn't kill anybody, then I should hide you. So what should I do? He says, I should be suspicious. I should worry that the information is true without acting on it. And also be suspicious of the fact that the information is not true and also act on that. Rabbi Tarfon's point highlights the dilemma, which is when we encounter a piece of information, frequently this piece of information is the kind where we don't know if it's true or false. And what the Gemara tells us we're supposed to do when we encounter information that we don't know is either true or false is we're supposed to say, maybe this piece of information is true. If this piece of information is true, certain things flow from it and I need to be careful. On the other hand, if this piece of information is false, then certain things I can discard, and what I need to do is I need to acknowledge the possibility that this gossip is correct and conduct myself in a certain way. This balance is a much more accurate depiction of Hilchot Lashon Hara than the one-sided recounting that you're frequently taught. Everybody is frequently taught the following rule: never repeat gossip and never assume it's true. That's a one-sided depiction of Hilchos Lashon Hara. The other side is that when you encounter a piece of information that could be true, you need to file it away in your head and say, you know, this piece of information could be true. I better be careful lest this information is true. So Gedalia ben Achikam is criticized because he's told there are people who are out there who want to kill him, and he says, I should pay no attention to that information because it's gossip, and he is ultimately punished. As Rashi puts it, Mechush le mibaya, v'shem haragtum v'asr lahatzil etchem. I have to worry. You know what? Maybe you Galileans really did kill somebody. And if you really did kill somebody, then what? I'm not allowed to help you escape. So even though you've come to me and you've said what all killers say, what do all killers say? I'm innocent. I didn't do it. I see that there's a rumor mill out there which says that you're guilty. And I can't assume just from the fact that you deny it that the popular rumor mill is totally false. I can't assume it's true. I can't assume it's false. I have to do something halfway in between. And this, in fact, becomes a central aspect in the real world of Hilchos Lashon Hara, which is every time you encounter a piece of information that's recounting damaging information about another, you shouldn't say to yourself, oh, since this is Lashon Hara, I should totally ignore it. You have to instead say to yourself, since this is Lashon Hara, I can't assume it's true. But on the other hand, I can't throw it out totally and completely because what? Maybe it really is true. And if it really is true, then certain consequences flow from this. This is what makes the halachas of Lashon Hara so complicated in the real world, which is there's a balance, really, between two distinctly different fields of halacha. One is the prohibition of lo tamod al dam re'echa, do not stand by while your neighbor's blood is shed, which means not only should you not stand by while your neighbor's blood is shed, but more generally, you have an obligation to interfere when you know things that are harmful to another person, and revealing that information will save the other person from the harm, with the notion that you shouldn't go around tattling and revealing information. Now, the Rosh, which we're going to only read out of the source, says something slightly different. The Rosh says, when people's lives are at stake, he disagrees with Rashi, and says when people's lives are at stake, you should operate to save their lives and not, in fact, believe gossip. But it's very hard to know how that plays out, because sometimes it's the gossiper's life who's at stake, and sometimes it's the lives of other people who are at stake. And in fact, this becomes a significant dispute among the Achronim of our day. Let's turn to page 5. The first source, which is source number 6. Im Echad Roeh, this is from the Chafetz Chaim Mishneh's famous work on Hilchos Lashon Hara. Im Echad Roeh, Shechaveiro Rotze, Lishtatef Be'ezah Devarim Echad, Vu Mishaer, Shebevadai Yisovlo Al Yedei Ze Inyan Ra. I know that two people want to get together to do harm to a third person, and I know this for certain. I have to tell the innocent person about the wrong that's coming to them. The Mishneh Berurah, however, emphasizes one important word. What's the central word in this paragraph? The word that makes it the word that makes this halacha less relevant according to the Mishneh Berurah? The crucial word is shevadai. What does the word shevadai mean? For sure. What does for sure mean? 100%, absolutely, no doubt at all. Now, Rabbi Chaim Ozer Grzinski, a slightly younger contemporary authority of the Mishneh Berurah, notes in his comments that he doesn't think the word shevadai is correct. He thinks that the proper word here is reasonable, and that this follows the rule no different than any other Torah prohibition. The general rule of Torah prohibition is what? The rule of majority. And he thinks that all I need to do to reveal information is that this information is more likely than not true. This is a very different standard in the real world, because according to the Mishneh Berurah, when I encounter two people plotting or planning to do harm to another person, I have to ask myself, am I 100% certain that this plot and plan is genuine? 100% certain is very complicated, because in the real world that we live in, people don't wear t-shirts which say, I'm a good person, or t-shirts which say, I'm a bad person. And even if they do, sometimes the bad people are tricky enough to wear t-shirts which say, I'm a good person. Because if you're a bad person, you're probably smart enough to put on a t-shirt every morning which says, I'm a good person. So it's very hard to know with certainty about anything. Rabbi Chaim Ozer's point says as follows. There's a mitzvah asay of lo tamod al dam reyecha. Do not stand by while your neighbor's blood is shed. And you're duty bound to follow that mitzvah when that application, when that reality is 51% likely or not. And when you know information that's harmful to another person, 51%, you're duty bound to go ahead and reveal it to spare this person the harm that's coming to them. And Rabbi Eliezer Waldenberg, it sits Eliezer, a contemporary halachic authority who died only a few years ago, I think at Kenahara, the age of 103, a very elderly man, adds something different. He draws a distinction between defensive Lashon Hara and offensive Lashon Hara. What does he mean? He says as follows. Imagine I hear a rumor that somebody's coming to kill me. So you know what I'm supposed to do, he says? Put on my bulletproof vest. Okay, how come? Because to kill him requires that I know he's coming to kill me. But when I put on my bulletproof vest, although I'm putting on my bulletproof vest because I heard a rumor, if it turns out the rumor is false, you know what? Nobody's harmed. Defensive Lashon Hara, defensive use of Lashon Hara, he says, is much more permissible. I hear a rumor that one of my employees is stealing from me. You know what I'm supposed to do? Order an audit. Order an audit. Everybody gets audited sometimes. Today it's his turn. And there's no harm in this because it doesn't say anything bad about the person if it turns out he's innocent, but it provides me with a lot of protection. When, after I put on my tzitzis, I put on my bulletproof vest, and nobody shoots at me, then what? Not a big deal. Even though it's true, I put on my bulletproof vest today only because I heard a piece of Lashon Hara that somebody was trying to kill me. In truth, the Tzitz Eliezer adds a significant intellectual point. There's two kinds of uses of Lashon Hara. One is where if it turns out that the information is false, I'm harming another person. And another situation where if it turns out the information is false, nobody's harmed. If I wear a bulletproof vest today and nobody shoots at me, nobody's harmed, nobody's besmirched, nobody's upset. Whereas if I kill a person because I heard a rumor that they're coming out to kill me, and it turns out the rumor was wrong, a terrible harm has exactly taken place. And the consensus of the poskim, I think, resides not with the Chafetz Chaim, the Mishnah Berurah. The consensus resides with Reb Chaim Ozer Grzinski and the Tzitz Eliezer. And it goes as follows. To engage in defensive Lashon Hara, you hear a rumor, and you don't know if the rumor is true or false, but you can prevent the rumor from doing harm in a way that does nobody else harm if the rumor is false. That's 100% mutter all the time. That's 100% mutter all the time, even though what you're doing is you're considering the possibility that the Lashon Hara is true, because that's exactly what the Gemara tells us Rabbi Tarfon was supposed to, did do, and what Gedalia ben Achikam was supposed to do but didn't do. So in a situation where you hear a rumor, and you don't know if the rumor is true or false, but you can avoid the ill effects of the rumor by doing something that harms nobody but insulates you, you're supposed to avoid the ill effects of the rumor in a way that harms nobody and insulates you. On the other hand, to actually repeat a piece of Lashon Hara in a way that's harmful to somebody else, but if it's true, it turns out is extremely important, that requires, the more likely than not, impact of the Lashon Hara. If you turn to page 2, I give you two hypotheticals to think about. Both of them are more or less grounded in Shilas that I've dealt with. It is Sunday afternoon at 3:30. Licensed marriage counselor calls and recounts the following. Marriage counselor has been counseling a couple with 3 children in their very difficult marriage. 10 days ago, at the end of the last counseling session, husband, age 42, announced that he was leaving the marriage and seeking divorce. Wife, age 40, threatened is a very important word, and cajoled him not to leave, and he agreed not to. Sometime this Saturday night or early Sunday morning, husband, still age 42, died in his sleep. Cause is unknown. Wife is set funeral for Monday morning. Police have walked door to door in the neighborhood asking if anyone has any reason to suspect any form of foul play and have gotten no positive response. Under the law in the state marriage counselor is in, a search warrant is needed to compel an autopsy against the wishes of the family. Wife will not give permission for autopsy, citing religious beliefs. Marriage counselor believes that if he tells the police what he knows, that will be enough to generate probable cause for a warrant to be issued and the autopsy done. This will delay the funeral in a day, at a minimum, and will also be public knowledge that probable cause was found to order an autopsy. Marriage counselor wants to know if he should, must, may, or must not speak to the police. What does marriage counselor know? She knows, marriage counselor knows, that wife threatened husband. But I don't know what the threat is, because it says in the case, she says, beg, threaten, and cajole. What else does marriage counselor suspect? She suspects, marriage counselor suspects maybe she killed him. Or whatever. But she, on the other hand, she didn't want him to leave. Maybe, though, he said to her, I'm leaving. And she suffocated him with a pillow. Or whatnot. I don't know. Marriage counselor knows very little. On the other hand, marriage counselor has a suspicion. Marriage counselor has a suspicion. Wife has refused to allow an autopsy. Maybe because the rabbi said there's no need for an autopsy. You didn't kill him. And she said, of course I didn't kill him. Is this Lashon Hara? You bet. This piece of information that marriage counselor is thinking about repeating is incredibly damaging to wife if it's false, and incredibly damaging to the three little children who just lost their father. Because marriage counselor is going to, if he speaks, cause the police to go get a warrant. To go get a warrant, they have to go swear out probable cause that a crime was committed, and they have to name the crime. What's the crime?
Murder.
And who's the murderess? Mother of the children, wife of him. Very, very damaging Lashon Hara if it's false. On the other hand, what? But if it's true, then it's very bad to let somebody get away with murdering another human being. On the other hand, if it's false, it's extremely destructive of her. Extremely destructive of her. And very, very, very damaging of the children at their time of loss. Somebody want to help me? You don't want to help? So the first approach says, well, what's the damage? The marriage counselor should call up. They'll do the autopsy. And the autopsy will reveal either A or B. Either it will reveal that he was suffocated by a fluffy pillow, in which case we need to know that piece of information, or it will reveal that he died of a stroke in his sleep, not her fault. One answer, which is very important, is here's the way our world works. Lashon Hara travels in big headlines, and retractions travel in small headlines. So the harm is as follows. The rumor mill will say, she was accused of killing her husband. And she was exonerated. Meaning most of us do not want to go through the process of being falsely accused and then exonerated. Meaning the way our world works is, she will go through her life in the face of a terrible tragedy with people repeating after her every time she seeks to date the following statement to the guy she's dating. She was accused of killing her husband, but no charges were brought. That's a hard line when you're dating again. That's sort of a very complicated entree point into the dating system, which is she was not in fact charged with killing her husband. She was just accused, but no charges were brought. Okay. That's not a good answer, because even when we have such laws, there are religious exemptions which she's taken advantage of. It happens, the answer is no. In most states, marriage counseling is totally different than child psychology, which is when you open up an office which says, I'm a child psychologist, you better be. Okay? But marriage counseling is a lot like a casual, informal profession, which is anybody can claim to be one, and it's not a licensed profession subject to state disclosure laws. So the answer is no, she's not under a duty to disclose. And on top of that, She doesn't have much to disclose. She doesn't have much to disclose. What she has, though, is a professional opinion. And her professional opinion is that given everything she saw, it's within the range of possible that she killed him. That's all she has. Well, the question is not, though, what you would do. These are not options available to you, the marriage counselor. You're the marriage counselor. When you call up the dead guy's doctor and say, can you share with me his medical records, you know what the doctor says? No. That's what he says. And when you call the wife up and say, I know you're in the process of burying your husband, but would you please come for a lie detector? No, she would say, drop dead. Meaning people don't respond to the, meaning if she's innocent and she's accused of murdering her husband, she'll probably grow very angry and non-cooperative, if you think about it. Meaning there are lots of ways to solve this problem if you can bring other things to bear. But the marriage counselor has none of these things. The marriage counselor has a simple question. The police are coming to my door to ask. They're going door to door in the neighborhood asking. When they knock on my door, what should I say? That's her question. By the way, another piece of information is, since the police are already going door to door asking, you know what? The rumor is out already. Maybe she's not really harmed. Because since the rumor mill is out already, the police don't go door to door frequently asking for foul play. And you don't have to be Albert Einstein to figure out if the police are going door to door asking if there's foul play, who they think committed the foul play either. There aren't a lot of candidates for foul play here, so maybe there's no harm to her to telling them the truth, because at the end of the day, the rumor's already out. You have to speak up. Sure. Do you want to know what she said? She said, the question is, what did the marriage counselor recount the threat was? And I'll tell you, in this particular case, the wife said to the husband, if you leave me, I'll kill myself. If the wife had said to the husband, if you leave me, I'll kill you, this would have been a much easier case. Because then I would have known, as a pretty good matter of halacha, since she said, if you think of leaving me, I'll kill you, and now he's dead, it's a much smaller leap to say she killed him. On the other hand, that isn't what she said. She said, in this case, if you leave me, I'll kill myself, which is a threat of violence. A threat of violence, but not a threat of violence against him. Her thought, the marriage counselor's thought, was as follows. Maybe it dawned on the wife that it's not so effective to kill herself. She would do a better job killing him. Killing him. That would seem to be, perhaps, from her view, more effective. But all of this is very speculative. All of this is very speculative. So if you think the Chafetz Chaim is correct, that you can only reveal information if the test is vadai, with certainty, I know for sure this case is not certain. If, on the other hand, you think Reb Chaim Ozer is correct, that you can reveal information when it's just more likely than not, which I think is the halacha, actually. I think the normal halacha follows the view of Reb Chaim Ozer, and the test is not vadai, the test is more likely than not, then what you turn to the marriage counselor and say is as follows. You're the only person who can answer this shaila, because you've been involved with this couple doing marriage counseling for a long time. Only you really know if you think the wife is capable of killing the husband. If you think the wife is capable of killing the husband, then you should tell the police what you think. If you don't think this, then obviously you shouldn't repeat it since you don't think it's correct. Sometimes the answers to these questions is very much driven by the facts, because facts don't come with probabilities. People don't say to you, I'll share with you a piece of Lashon Hara, it's 73% likely to be accurate. It's 42% likely to be accurate. This piece of information is only 16% likely to be accurate. Lashon Hara, like most sinful activities, doesn't come with precise measures of its accuracy. But the point here is that the marriage counselor has had many years of interacting with his family. Only she can realistically assess whether she thinks it's plausible that she killed him. On the other hand, and it's important not to fall into this trap, you might say, well, why should I report anything? After all, if she did kill him, you know what? He's dead. This is not covered by the future crimes rule. But it's very important to emphasize that which we know, which is criminal activity is recurrent. And we should never fall into the trap of saying, I know something bad happened yesterday, I shouldn't report it because yesterday is behind us. If we've learned anything from everything that we've seen in the last 10 years, it's that bad people are recurringly bad until they get caught. If she did kill him, although he's quite dead and there's nothing that can be done to bring him back, there's a moral, religious, halachic imperative to catch her. Because people who kill in response to frustrations, you know what? They kill again. And it's important not to let her get away. The mitzvah min haTorah of ubi'arta hara mikirbecha, of eradicating the evil in your midst, is hard. We have a much better time of fulfilling the mitzvah of eradicating the evil in somebody else's midst. That's even entertaining. But eradicating evil in our own midst is very, very important. When we see a person doing a wrong like this, we can't run a good society if we let people get away with this. If, in fact, this woman did this, then we need to take every step we can to catch her. Although it's not a topic for this year, it's sufficient to note that Hilchos Mesira, like Hilchos Lashon Hara, are overemphasized in their prohibitive effect and underemphasized in their permissive effect. When you see somebody doing something terribly wrong in our community, calling the police sounds like a good idea. It doesn't sound like a bad idea. And notwithstanding the fact that you're occasionally told here and there on the prohibition of Mesira, of informing, it should be emphasized that this shouldn't stand in the way of catching people who recurringly do wrong in our community. Let's turn to number two. Here we have a little bit of a more complicated problem. You're a tax lawyer in a firm and a part-time shul rabbi. And due to a slip of the tongue of two of your colleagues in a competing firm, one of whom mentioned that Reuven Goldberg has come to his firm as a new client with interesting business, and another whom asked your advice about a criminal tax matter, saying the firm rarely does this criminal work, but a new client came in with a very serious criminal tax matter and is facing indictment. You suspect that Reuven Goldberg might be facing criminal tax charges. Why do you suspect this? Because you're no dummy. You heard two pieces of information, and the overlap of these two pieces of information points to Reuven. Piece of information number one is Reuven came to a competing firm and hired them as a law firm. And piece of information number two is this law firm rarely does criminal tax. And somebody called you and said a new client walked in with a criminal tax matter. He's got a doozy of a problem. Can you give me some advice? Now, you connected A and B and said what? Could be Reuven. Now, could it not be Reuven?
Yeah.
For sure. Do you know it's Reuven?
No.
No. Do you even have a suspicion that it's Reuven? The answer is no. You have two pieces of information which make it statistically likely that it's Reuven. But you don't know anything particular about Reuven that would cause you to think it's Reuven. What you have is a coincidence. Sometimes coincidences are just coincidental. On the other hand, sometimes coincidences are not coincidences at all. They're God's way of sharing information with you. Many members of your shul know Reuven, because he's a congregant, well, and you face the following two questions. Stephen, a congregant in your shul asks you, if you know anything about Reuven, as Reuven asked Steve to lend Reuven $50,000 for 30 days. You know, as a shul rabbi, you get these questions all the time. Somebody comes to you and says, Rabbi, I'm interested in doing business with one of your congregants. Can you tell me something about your congregant? They're not interested in hearing that he's a nice man. And they're not interested in hearing that he lanes very nicely, or he regularly comes to Minyan, or not. Or whether he's in Shul Shabbos morning before Baruch Shemar, or only before Ein Kelkeinu. What information are they looking for? They want to know, do I know something about this person that would cause them not to do business? Whether you come to davening before or after Baruch Shemar, I would like to, in some ideal world, think relates to your honesty in business, but I'm not sure. So Steve has come to me and said, do you know anything about Reuven? As Reuven asked Steve to lend Reuven $50,000 for 30 days. Somebody want to help answer this question? I found in my life in the rabbinate that everybody thinks they can be the rabbi until hard questions come in. That's what I found in the rabbinate. I have a shul full of people who could be the rabbi until hard questions come in, and then they say, no, you're the rabbi. Somebody want to help here? Tell Steve, craft an answer for Steve. Steve says, Rabbi, Reuven asked me for a loan. Sure. Well, Steve's answer, the suggestion was I should say to Steve, well, are you okay never getting your money back? Now, the answer with $50,000 loans is no. I'm asking you this, Rabbi, because I only make $50,000 loans when I expect to get the money back. Is there any reason why I should think Reuven won't repay my money no different than anybody else? That's the point. You know, when people ask me, can I borrow $3? So the answer frequently is, although we use the word ask, what we mean is give. And the word ask is just a polite language. It's like, can I borrow a tissue? So can I borrow a tissue is not a language of borrowing. The answer is that I'm happier to give you a tissue with the understanding you not give it back to me than I lend you a tissue with the understanding that you give it back to me. So borrow sometimes in English means take. But when it's followed by the words $50,000, it's rarely used in the context of take. It means borrow. If I say to Steve, sure, you can lend Reuven the money, but don't expect to get it back, Steve's answer is, I'm out of here because I want to get the money back.
I have to be careful about it. Just say, well, I know he just joined so-and-so's company because he's
said
he's invested in the other firm. He hasn't
invested in the base,
and maybe he should be
into
the
invested. Sure, so I should say, I don't know, go talk to them. The problem with that is twofold. I do know. I don't know for sure, but maybe I'm under a duty to provide Steve with what? The best advice I can. What's the best? If there was no halacha here at all, what would you say is the best advice? Sure, I could punt. I could say to Steve, I don't know, go ask Reuven's co-workers. I got that, but the problem is that I do know. It may be the act of punting is itself wrong, because I know a piece of information. I don't know it for sure, but I know something that seems relevant, which is I have reason to think, could be wrong, I have reason to think that Reuven is facing indictment. I can always punt. As a rabbi, anybody can say, can't help you, so sorry. But it's important to understand, Rabbi Chaim Ozer's point goes as follows. When you don't help, but you could, that's a sin too. That's a sin too. Steve is entitled to the Torah's prohibitions of lo tamod al dam re'echa for his $50,000. Because losing $50,000 is not like losing a tissue or a nickel. And if I know something that would prevent Steve's loss of $50,000, I have to tell him. So punting when I shouldn't punt is just as wrong as not punting when I should. Right, so now you're asking a very important halakhic question. I have to close my eyes and say, I encountered these two pieces of information. How likely is it, in fact, that Reuven is facing criminal tax indictment? Should I pick up the phone and say, hey, Reuven, you know I'm your shul rabbi, but you also know that I'm a part-time tax lawyer. I work at blank firm. I was speaking to the lawyers at this firm, and you'll never believe I heard these two pieces of information. Hey, Reuven, are you facing criminal tax indictment? Do you think I have to call up and ask Reuven? Let me go further than that. Not only would Reuven might not tell me the truth, I'm allowed to make the following assumption. If Reuven is facing criminal tax indictment, you know what he'll do? He will for sure lie. That's exactly Rabbi Tarfon's point. Rabbi Tarfon must have turned to these Galileans who were accused of murder. And you know what he must have asked them? Did you kill him? And you know what they said? No, because you never meet anybody who acknowledges their crime. And Rabbi Tarfon didn't believe them because Rabbi Tarfon was no idiot. He knew that when you go to a guilty person and ask, are you guilty? You know what the guilty person says? Of course not. I'm totally innocent. I probably have no reason to call Reuven. Because if Reuven is innocent, he'll tell me he's innocent. And if Reuven is guilty, he'll also tell me he's innocent. And returning the rumor all the way back to Reuven for no purpose is a classical form of rechilut, which is I go back to a person and repeat information I heard that really just aggravates them. Going back to a person is most complicated because almost never do they have an incentive to tell you the truth. So I don't think I have to go back to Reuven to ask him because I have an in the alternative argument. If he's innocent, he'll tell me he's innocent. And if he's guilty, he'll tell me he's innocent anyway. So there's no point in asking the question of Reuven because the additional information will add nothing to the conversation. So I have to ask myself, do I think it's more likely than not that Reuven is facing tax indictment? And when I come to the conclusion that the answer is yes, now what do I say to Steve? What's the truth? I haven't heard any such rumor. I have not heard any such rumor. That would be an incredible exaggeration. I've not heard a single sentence in English which connects the name Reuven Goldberg with tax indictment. I can't hear you. So one approach the poskim say is to not repeat a thing. Since I can't convey the information, really, I should just say to Steve, don't lend Reuven the money. I won't tell you why. That's one group of achronim. The problem with that is as follows. I'm afraid. What am I afraid? Steve will go around saying something is terribly wrong with Reuven, and it's so bad, you know what? The rabbi wouldn't even tell me. And maybe the unimaginable wrong is even worse than the truth. He'll go around saying even more heinous things about Reuven than tax fraud. Another possibility, which is the view Rabbi Chaim Moser himself adopts, is that I should say to Steve the total truth, which is, hey Steve, you know I work part-time as a tax lawyer. I heard two unrelated pieces of information. One, that Reuven became a client of the firm next to me, and two, the firm next to me suddenly needed somebody who knew criminal tax fraud, and thus I was worried that Reuven is this person. I don't know the truth. But there are two basic approaches in the Achronim as to how to handle this one. One says, just say to Steve, go away, don't lend him the money. And the other is to say to Steve, here's exactly what I know. By the way, the Tzitz Eliezer notes in his defensive Lashon Hara that I can say something a little bit less with even less problems. He says, I can say to Steve, you can lend him the money, but do yourself a favor, get collateral. By saying that, get collateral, I'm giving him a defensive piece of information, not an offensive piece of information, and I can do that then without revealing any of the details, since I've given him a piece of advice whose core is defensive. Rachel asks you about setting up Reuven's daughter with her son. She asks, as they all do, Rabbi, is there anything I need to be aware of? I find answering shidduch questions to be so hard, much harder than business questions. Because when people are looking at marriage issues, they're looking at a much broader set of data points than business decisions. Steve, when he's asking about his loan, he has only one data point that's important to him. What does he care about? We get his money back. He's not interested in finding out if Reuven davens nicely, or is a good fellow, or is somebody who he'd like to have as a member of his family. That's like much more complicated. Shidduch questions are much more complicated. On the other hand, Rachel isn't asking if she should marry Reuven. Rachel is asking if Reuven would make a good mechutan. Mechutan, and by the way, mechutanim are pretty distant. I'm here for Rosh Hashanah because my oldest son, Joshua, got married and is living in the Heights, and we're staying in the apartment next door as the visiting in-laws for Rosh Hashanah, and it reminds you of the joke that the difference between in-laws and outlaws when they come visit is outlaws are at least wanted. So it's a very complicated situation. Rachel here is asking a much broader question. At some level, maybe the fact that Reuven is facing tax indictment has nothing to do with whether Reuven's daughter would get along well with Rachel's son. It sounds utterly irrelevant. He'll face tax indictment, the two of them will be happy anyway. On the other hand, maybe it's much more relevant because who wants to have your mechutanim have to ask the judge for permission to leave prison to come to the wedding? That sounds like exceptionally awkward, to say the least. Is it relevant or not here? I don't know. This is a more complicated case with much more uncertainty. Because after all, Rachel is not marrying Reuven, and maybe really who your in-laws are not so relevant. Thank God you don't marry your in-laws. And they're secondary in the relationship. Maybe, in fact, the relevance of the highly specific question Steve has, which is, will I get my $50,000 back? Which is the sort of very specific question which you have extremely relevant pieces of information about, is much less relevant to Rachel's question of, is Reuven's daughter really right for my son? I find this question to be very, very hard. I never know what is Reb Chaim Ozer's more likely than not relevant information when people ask me about shidduch questions. In business questions, I know what relevant information is. Relevant information is the kind of information you need to make a prudent business decision. In the shidduch universe, it's just a much harder situation with much less certainty. I'm not 100% sure what is the right answer in halacha. And it might, by the way, vary depending on the community. In a hard shidduch community, where you form a family with your mechutanim. It might be more relevant than in parts of the modern Orthodox community where every couple is alone. I'm not sure. So prudent people, when I say, what do you want to know, they smile and they say, Rabbi, what do you have to tell me? Meaning, people are, I've discovered, are at least as smart as me. And when I say to them, well, what do you want to know? They ask me, well, Rabbi, what do you have to say? Meaning, tell me anything that I think is wrong with this person. So when I start by telling them all the nice things about this person, they say, yada, yada, yada. Meaning, they say, I didn't come to you to find out all the good things that they are. I came to you to find out what's terribly wrong. Okay. I don't know how to answer these questions. So I view this aspect of Hilchos Lashon Hara, the single hardest aspect of Reb Chaim Ozer Grudzinski's view, doesn't come up in financial matters, which are readily quantified and easily understood. It's about money. It comes up much more complexly in interpersonal matters, where it's genuinely hard to figure out how likely a piece of information is to be true, and then to figure out how relevant this truthful piece of information is to the situation at hand. Steve's tax indictment is extremely relevant to whether Reuven's tax indictment is extremely relevant in the determination as to whether he'll be able to repay the $50,000. It's less relevant in the determination as to whether Reuven's daughter will be a good wife to Rachel's son. It's just much less relevant. It sometimes fails the litoela test, the determination to make sure that even if the information is accurate, you're repeating it in a situation in which it's relevant. It's important to understand, and it really needs to be emphasized in our community over and over again, that the halachos of Lashon Hara are a balance between the need not to reveal information that shouldn't be revealed and the need to reveal information that must be revealed. You can't be too strict in Hilchos Lashon Hara, because if you're too strict in Hilchos Lashon Hara, you end up not revealing information that needs to be revealed, causing terrible harm to people. On the other hand, you can't be too lenient either, because then you become a gossiper who goes around incessantly repeating information. You have to get this one just right. Revealing information that needs to be revealed while simultaneously clamming up for information that doesn't need to be revealed. Gedalia ben Achikam, who was an eminent person and a great leader of the Torah community 2,500 years ago, didn't get this right. And he paid a very serious price. That's a lesson to us all on the need to balance this area of halacha correctly. Have a wonderful day.